This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women around you who we can call heroes because they have done things for the sake of our freedom that many of us can't even imagine going through. That is certainly going to be the case today as we listen to a story of one of America's ex-prisoners of war. But the idea behind the show is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're always entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I have the privilege of introducing you today to 92-year-old Ray Maloney. I'm catching up with him down in Bonita Springs, Florida. Maybe you see him up in the Northeast. He's one of those snowbirds on the East Coast. But many years ago, he was wondering if he'd ever make it back to the East Coast, a prisoner, a guest of the Gestapo overseas during World War II. We'll get to that, but let's start early, Ray. Growing up in Long Island, New York. See how I said that? Did I get that right?
You got that right.
All right.
Accent on the G.
That's right. Yeah. The second word starts with a G, I think.
Yeah, right.
So you grew up there. What was life like there in the 1930s and early 40s?
Well, my father worked as a customs officer in New York Harbor. And so during the Depression, he worked all the time. Fortunately, you know, we had food on the table, but we were never could be called well off or anything of that sort. We lived in 31st Street in Brooklyn, just off 4th Avenue. My brother came 10 years after I was born, and my mother was English, and she was a war bride from World War I.
Wow.
My father had fought in France and was wounded, shot through the chest and then gassed, mustard gas attack, and was convalescing in England in a British hospital and got friends with a British soldier in the next bed. And when they were convalescing and had a little time to themselves, they went downtown looking for some action, of course, and picked up two sisters. And my father married one of them, and this other fellow, Jack Calaver, he married the other one.
How about that?
So they split these two. And so my mother came from England. She was English then, of course. And we lived in Brooklyn. That's where I was born and grew up until, I guess I was about 10 or 12, and then we moved out to Long Island, St. Albans, and went to high school there. Started work on a bank in Times Square, 1941, I guess it was.
When you talk about your father marrying your mother, a war bride, it strikes me you would have never been born if your dad didn't get wounded in World War I.
That's true. That's right. It would have been somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I always tell those stories about World War II veterans, but this in this case, it's your dad who was wounded and gassed in World War I, and
that's
how he meets your mom. So, okay, so you're in Long Island. You're working at a bank in 1941.
Yeah, I worked for about better part of a year, and then the war started, you know, December 41.
What do you remember about that day, December 7th? How'd you find out?
I think it was a Sunday, of course.
Yeah.
I was with another couple of friends of mine, and we were sitting in a car listening to the news on the radio, and we heard about the attack, you know, on Pearl Harbor. And, you know, everybody, you know, it changed everybody's lives at that point. I was always interested in the sea because I grew up on Long Island. I used to sail and boat and fish. My father was a great fisherman. And so I tried the Navy Air Corps, and they said I had a heart murmur. And I was totally crushed. And some other friends of mine said, we're going to go down and try the Army Air Corps. So they said, come along. So I said, all right. So I went down early in the morning to Grand Central Station, which is where they had their recruiting thing that day. And by about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I was standing there. I promised to, you know, defend the Constitution. So I was in the Army, and they never said a peep about a heart murmur. And that's the last they ever heard of it.
Uh-huh.
So if I had one, the Army didn't care. So I went in and enlisted in, I think it was November or December of 42. And I started my flight training in January of 43 and got my wings in February of 44. You know, you get a commission and your wings. For flight training, you go to primary, basic, and then finally advanced. And in primary, it was at Bennettsville, South Carolina, and I had a rebel instructor, and we didn't have electrical phone connection between front cockpit and the back. It was a steerman. I don't know if you know the steerman, biplane, you know, with open cockpits.
Saw one a couple of weeks ago.
Did
touch
you?
The wing. Yeah,
that was a great little airplane, yeah. Well, anyway, my instructor was a rebel from the South, and I couldn't understand him. Right? You know, he had such a bad accent. And as I say, we didn't have electrical, you know, radio connection. They had a little tube that he shouted through, and, you know, I would hear him shouting, and I wouldn't understand what it was. And I think I had about three or four flights with him, and he had other students. It was about four or five of us per instructor. And he mentioned to the other students in his little group, he said, "What's the matter with the Maloney? He doesn't do what I tell him to do." So he says he can't understand. He's got no feel. So and they said, "Well, we don't know, but we'll ask him." And so I had a conversation one night with him, with my friends, and they spelled it out. They said that you got to listen to him. You know, tell him to talk a little slower. But they told the instructor that yes, he wants to be a pilot. He wants to be a fighter pilot, and all the rest of it. So they went through the little takeoff procedures where you have to fly out and then 45-degree turn right and out of the traffic padding and then climb out, you know, all this kind of protocols that you have to go through. When I heard that, I said, is that all he was asking about? Or just to take off, go to 800 feet, make a 45 and climb? He says, yeah. So the next day, I got in it and with the instructor in the back and I did what I found. And he came down and he said, "What's happened? What have you done?" And I said, "I can understand what it was you wanted. I couldn't understand." So from that point on, he calmed down, talked slower, and in 7.5 hours, I soloed. You know, so I was right with the class then, and then I had no trouble getting through flight school at all. Yeah.
The Yankee and the Rebel needed a translator
somewhere
in between,
did.
Huh?
That's all it was. I couldn't understand him. And the payoff was, remember, his name was John Paul Jones.
How about that?
Yeah, yeah. John Paul Jones.
And it's too bad you didn't know that, you know, 50 years later you'd be sailing the Bounty. Otherwise, you could have traded some naval stories.
That's true.
We'll get to that. You were talking about the P-40, and I think P-40. I interrupted you to ask about training, but what was it that was so challenging about the P-40?
Well, it's the first fighter that you get to fly.
Yeah.
And you're used to, you know, what training planes are, and they're good aircraft and so forth. AT-6 was the one that was our advanced trainer. But you get in a fighter, and it's a whole new world because now you have an aircraft that's mean and built for performance and nothing else, you know. And the joke of it was that on your first flight that you take in the P-40, you don't get your head out of the cockpit till the airplane's at 4,000 feet and going, you know. It's a whole way awakening for you. You know, you got to now catch up because the airplane is, even that one, by, you know, training plane standards, was so fast that you're going to have to wake up and get ahead of this thing or it's going to kill you.
Yeah.
You know, so that becomes a challenge right there. You've got to master it. Or you won't be around, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's something that I think most people don't realize, how many Americans lost their lives in the States during World War II just training
access,
in these planes that were really brand new in a lot of ways.
That's right, yeah.
But fortunately, you weren't among that number. And fortunately, there was a special someone in your life that you decided to take a certain step with before you headed overseas, huh?
Yeah, well, I knew Christina. She was in high school when I met her, and I had just graduated. I was working at that bank in Times Square. And we started to date, and I didn't even have a car then. I had to take a bus to get over to, you know, and I'd get back at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, from having a date with her. I was, as I say, a poor Irish kid from Brooklyn, you know, just going through the motions of living.
And what made you decide to ask her to marry you before you went over? Because a lot of guys said, you know, let me make sure I get back from this before we take a step like that.
Well, you know, I probably wasn't thinking right, but, you know, you have a lot of the hormones going, and kind of off the cuff, you think, oh, well, if I'm going over to the war, I'm probably going to get killed, so I might as well enjoy myself before I go, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I did love her, and she loved me, and I didn't want her to get away, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, if I go over there, you know, there's a lot of guys that won't be there, and she'll be dating, so I asked her to marry me before I went, and she said fine. So we did.
Well, I guess 70 years later, you could say that was a wise decision?
Yeah, I think it's lasting, yeah. it's going to last.
When did you head overseas, and what do you remember thinking about that? Now, after all this training, you're going to get a chance to go over there and do something about this enemy.
We went over on an army transport. And in those days, most ships that were going to Europe would go in a convoy. But for some reason, our troop transport was a fast ship. It was called the Richardson, I think, the USS Richardson. And as I say, it was an army transport. And it headed straight for Gibraltar. One day out of Gibraltar, we picked up a British destroyer to escort us. And we went through, you know, the straits there at Gibraltar, and then went along the African coast. Just a few miles, we could see the African coast. And I think it was 2 days before we landed in Naples. Late in the day, about 5 o'clock, you know, at sunset, all of a sudden, all the bells and whistles went off, and the destroyer went screaming off in a direction, and the ship came to a dead stop. And it turned, we had heard later that they picked up a submarine contact, German submarine. And I don't know whether they got it or not, but we sat there for about 3 or 4 hours while the destroyer was out there chasing this thing. And then finally we kind of snuck along the African coast and finally made it over to Italy. And we landed in Naples. And I remember my first impression of now I'm in the war was we tied up at a long pier in Naples, Italy, and the pier had a ship tied up at the pier that had been bombed by the Germans, had capsized on its side. Rather than move it, I guess they couldn't, they cut off all the superstructure on that side of the ship, and we tied up on the ship, and it had gangplanks that went across the hull and then down to the dock. You know, and that's it. And so when we were doing this, boy, you got to get hurt over here, you know.
Yeah.
And the ship had capsized right at the dock, and you walked across it to get to the dock.
Yeah, I think that would get my attention, too.
Yeah, it does, you know. Yeah.
And by this time, you were in a squadron, 527th Squadron of the 86th Fighter Bomber Group, flying P-47s.
Well, they had just transitioned. They had been flying the dive bomber version of the Mustang, the P-51.
Yeah.
Remember, it was called the A-36.
The A-36 Apache. Yep.
Yeah, it had dive brakes. And they had just were transitioning into the P-47 when we got there. And then they picked us up at an airport near Naples and flew us over to Bastia in Corsica. And the 86 was there. This would have been late July. There was a whole row along the east coast of Corsica. There must have been 6 or 8 airfields, you know, side by side. And we're all getting ready for the invasion of southern France. And my very first mission was to, we tried to dive bomb a French battleship, the Richelieu, in Marseille Harbor, because they were worried about the Germans or the French might put it to sea and then, you know, entangle with the task force that was going to come in and invade southern France. So they wanted to put it out of action. And I didn't hit it. And I think there were 8 of us. And I think 2 of them got close enough to where they might have damaged it somewhat. But the rest of it, I missed it. And I guess for maybe another month or two, we flew our missions into southern France. And you must know enough about the Air Force, and you would appreciate it. The pointy end of the spear in terms of the Air Force was strategic bombing or tactical bombing, you know. And the strategic Air Force, the 8th Air Force, was in England, and it had the long-range bombers and the long-range fighters, the Mustangs, after the P-47s. And then there was the 9th Air Force, which was a tactical Air Force, started out in England, and then when the invasion came, moved to France. And the tactical guys moved up with the front lines because their job was to support the ground advance, you know, mm-hmm. shooting up trucks and trains and bridges and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And in Italy, we had the same situation. The Strategic Air Force was the 15th down at Foggia in southern Italy. And they ranged up into Germany and, you know, the Balkans. And they had 51s for the escort. But then the 12th Air Force, which was the one I was in, was the tactical Air Force. And our job was to support the advance up Italy. And then the invasion went so well, I remember the words were coming back that stop bombing the bridges anymore because we were actually slowing up the advance. Yeah. You know, so they put us, then moved us back over to Italy to Grosseto. It's on the west coast, about halfway up. And I was flying out of Grosseto when we were getting ready to move up again to Pisa, you know, where the Leaning Tower is.
Sure.
And I was in B Party. The A Party had already moved up, and the B Party was getting ready to move up, and we were still flying missions every day. And that's when I got hit and shot down.
And it's a wonder you survived that. We're going to hear all about it, but I want to hear more about your earlier missions, too, when we come back. 92-year-old Ray Maloney of Bonita Springs, Florida, is our guest. He doesn't sound 92, does he? When you hear what he survived, you'll be able to imagine why he might feel like he's been living on borrowed time for the last 7 decades. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.